Welcome to Claim Edge, your resource for litigated claims management and resolution. I'm Jim Chapman, your host, and today we'll be joined by our guest, Sarana McMurtry from Acceptance Insurance, where Sarana is Senior Vice President and General Counsel. As General Counsel, she heads the legal enterprise and leads a team of lawyers for her company. Sarana shared her personal story of how she got into insurance and her journey to General Counsel of a property and casualty insurance company. I enjoyed the conversation with Sarana, and I'm sure you will too. Some background about Acceptance Insurance. The company is a non-standard auto personal lines insurance carrier that write coverage in 15 states through a network of agents. Their business model is providing auto insurance for high-risk drivers. So obviously, they pay a lot of attention to claims, and especially the ones that end up in lawsuits. Acceptance is also a publicly traded company, so Sarana has a full legal plate. Because the Claim Edge podcast is focused on litigated claims, today we'll be talking with Sarana about claims lawsuits and coverage disputes. And we'll wrap up our conversation with a look at the effects of social movements on claims in the insurance industry. So we're glad you joined us. I'm delighted to have Sarana as our guest, so let's tune in. I'm delighted today to have as our guest Sarana McMurtry, who is the Senior Vice President and General Counsel of Acceptance Insurance. Welcome, Sarana.
Thanks, Jim. Glad to be here.
Well, so glad you could join us. I know that you've been in a claims leadership role for a good while now with Acceptance, but I know our audience is always interested in how you got into insurance. What brought you here?
Well, I think like a lot of people, what got me here was I needed a job, and I found a position as a paralegal and worked in that role for about 18 months, and it was with an insurance defense firm. And that gave me the desire to go to law school. I graduated from law school and worked in the insurance defense field for a number of years as a litigator, but my practice became more and more focused on insurance coverage and bad faith claim handling and litigation matters involving bad faith and coverage. And eventually I had the opportunity to come in-house at Acceptance as the claims counsel. And I've been here at Acceptance now 16 years.
So mostly a coverage-related experience in your kind of coming up in the insurance industry.
Yes, very much focused on coverage. I like coverage a lot. I like reading insurance policies. There's probably not a lot of folks that will say that, but I love it.
Well, they're always interesting from the standpoint of, you know, what are the facts, right? And can they be applied to find coverage, which I know is really the approach insurance companies take. But if it's not covered, you know, you have to deal with that too.
That's probably one of the biggest things that you have to learn as an adjuster, and that I have spent a lot of time teaching adjusters, is how do you approach a coverage analysis? How do you determine whether a claim is covered or not covered?
So just thinking about that from your perspective, what's best practices?
Best practices is to make sure that you read the entire policy. You don't just pick out the pieces that you think might work. And a coverage analysis is really something that has a detail and a pattern to it. Start by looking at the insuring agreement. Is this even the type of claim that was intended to be insured by this policy? Is it a bodily injury or property damage as the result of an auto accident caused by an insured? There's three key things there: bodily injury, property damage, auto accident, insured. If you don't have those, that's not even the right policy to be looking at. Next, look at your section of your policy and determine, do the facts apply to this? If they do, then the next place you're going to look is to the exclusions. Is there some exclusion that would take away coverage because of the particular facts and circumstances of this accident? And even within an exclusion, you may find that there is something called an exception to that exclusion. And that exception gives back coverage when certain facts apply or don't apply in that factual setting. So all of those things have to be looked at. In addition, insurance policies have definitions. You got to look at those and apply those in the context, because definitions aren't always what we think they are in the common use of that word. An auto, we know what an auto is when we look out the window and see cars sitting out there. But an auto in an insurance policy has a very specific definition: number of wheels, weight, what it can carry, those kinds of things.
Yeah, the devil is always in those details. Years ago, I did some coverage work in the marine space, and the definitions were always, you could get tripped up over them pretty easily. And I remember a case that I had over whether a boat, a vessel, was in use or not in use at the time of the fire that consumed it. And if it was in use, there was coverage. And if it wasn't in use, there wasn't.
You know, we look at things like that too. Was the person in or upon the motor vehicle? That can make a difference. Were they up on the motor vehicle? Were they vehicle oriented, not vehicle oriented? Totally different coverage outcome depending on that answer.
Yeah. So I gather at acceptance, it's a pretty straightforward, I'll call it diet of auto claims, because that's your business model, right?
We write primarily what they call non-standard auto, and that is auto for high-risk customers. They're folks that can't get policies on the standard market, primarily because of their driving records. It may also be because of their payment histories. They've allowed a policy to lapse at some point, but it is all auto. A very small percentage of our business is also renters coverage.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Do you guys write the auto in all 50 states?
We write in 17 states. We're licensed in about 13 more. We also have separately an agency that sells in 15 states and have stores spread out across those states and about 300 total locations.
Gotcha. So it sounds like you have at least the continental United States covered.
For claims are concerned, absolutely. our actual written business isn't in all 50 states, but we cover claims that occur in all 50 states. One month, I can remember a couple of years ago, I had two Alabama insureds, totally unrelated, had nothing to do with each other, but both of them had accidents in Alaska.
Oh, gosh.
And we had to figure out how Alaska law and would apply to those particular losses.
So that raises an interesting question. I assume that you hire outside counsel for the most part, maybe exclusively to represent the insureds when there is coverage, right?
We do. We retain counsel, outside counsel, and have a panel that we call upon in most states. We've already got that panel designated, but in a state like Wyoming, for example, I can have an accident happen there and I'm going to have to go and look for outside counsel because we don't have a current relationship or panel in that state. We have very recently, as a company, opened a staff counsel operation in Florida. But that operation is limited to handling personal injury protection or PIP claims in Florida and also windshield glass claims in the state of Florida.
Yeah, Florida is a tough state in terms of first party claims. I think it makes a lot of sense to stand up a staff counsel operation to handle as much of that as possible.
Well, that's what we're hoping for, and it seems to be paying off. We're in the early stages of it. We've only had the staff counsels set up since September of 2021, but we're already seeing the benefit. Windshield glass in particular is one of those areas where it seems to be beneficial to have the staff counsel operation. It is one of the hot buttons of fraud in Florida right now.
Speaking of hot buttons, from your perspective, what are the big challenges that you're grappling with, or maybe the industry is grappling with in the claims world?
Well, I think in the claims world, and in particular in the auto industry, the personal lines auto industry, we're dealing with an unprecedented set of circumstances. We've got supply chain issues that are delaying parts getting to suppliers and repair shops to fix automobiles. That is extending the time involved in the reparation of a vehicle. The value of autos, there's a supply chain issue even with regard to autos themselves, and that's causing the value of autos to spike. Used autos have risen a crazy amount since January of 2021. We saw it really come into play probably in Q2, Q3 of 2021. And if you look at some of the industry information, you'll see that it took a sharp just upward spike, which is costing a tremendous amount of money when you're trying to value total loss vehicles. The delays are also resulting in increased costs in rental because vehicles are, you know, folks are having to rent for longer while their vehicle is being repaired, if it can be repaired. Interestingly enough, though, I think on the other side, and maybe this is a positive, at least in the auto industry, is we have seen the frequency of accidents go down. And I think that part of that is there's less miles being driven. We're still coming out of COVID. So overall, people have been driving less. And of course, there's a spike in gas prices. And at least in particular with our market, we're in the non-standard world. Our customers are very sensitive to changes in economic costs. And gas prices will cause them to stop driving. So that is become a trend that we are seeing. I would say the other one we've seen is the severity. And that is, even though we see less frequency, I think a lot of carriers, and we have seen this in particular, it seems like that severity has become much more significant in a lot of claims.
Yeah, I'd say, you know, we probably all witnessed this personally. You're out driving on the interstate, and the speed at which people travel today, it feels sort of like there's a level of insanity to it and a certain amount of recklessness associated with it. So I think the accidents are getting worse. They might be fewer, but they're more expensive.
That's what it feels like from our perspective, as in our particular segment. Yes.
Yeah. You mentioned gas prices as a reason that your customers might not drive as much, but also COVID had an impact on that. And while the world seems to be loosening up, I wanted to ask you about how remote work has worked for acceptance. You know, whether you're experiencing good things, challenging things around that.
Well, I think kind of a mixture of good and bad. The good is that we've discovered as a company that remote work can work. We have had a great success in working remotely and maintaining our business and our employees. But it brings with it some challenges. We're constantly looking at the quality of the work that's produced, because especially in claims and with claims adjusters, that remote, when you're working remote and you're sitting at home, you don't have the same opportunities for collaboration. You can't just yell over the cube, "Hey, I got this case. You know, what do you think about that?" And get that experience from the collective experience that you get of the adjusters around you and the mentoring that comes from people who've been doing these kinds of work for so much longer. That's a chore. But what we've found is Zoom helps us some with that.
Yeah, there's no sort of true substitute for that over-the-cube approach that you just described. Zoom is at best a substitute, but not a great one. Are you guys looking at any other technology platforms that could potentially help with that?
Right now, no, we're not. We've primarily used Zoom. We've used Teams some, but I think part of it was getting everybody equipped to participate actively. And we've settled into some pretty good practices with that. Now, the constant we have with even the technology is security and privacy, because when you've got remote workers, you always have a concern about the security of the workspace, privacy aspects of it. But in general, Zoom has worked for us.
So from a claim perspective, are you using Zoom at all to engage with your insureds? Or is that still strictly either a kind of a traditional phone call or maybe email or text type channel?
We're still pretty much limited to phone, text, and email with our customers and claimants.
How much of the workforce is remote currently, at least in claims?
Oh, probably about 85 or 90% of our current claims workforce is remote. One of the things that we have done during this time of everyone being remote is we actually engaged in an office remodel and have kind of consolidated space. So our remote work will go down a little bit as the remodel is finished up, and we're going to actually start moving into our updated space beginning May 25th. Okay. The executive team moves, and then during the month of June, they're going to move everybody else. But what that actually is doing is we're getting rid of a claims office.
Oh, no kidding.
In order to, we've been able to, because of the remote work, to consolidate space.
Yeah, you just didn't need the square feet.
Correct, yeah.
Same with files?
No, we still need all those adjusters to handle the files. And we've been paperless for a long time, so we certainly don't have a lot of stacks of files around like we used to when I first started doing this.
I read recently an article that you co-wrote for DRI.
Yes, about social movements.
Yeah, the impact of social movements on the insurance industry in general. But I wanted to just kind of ask you a little bit about that. What was the impetus for that article? And I'll get into a little more detail too, but.
Well, I think just all the things that we've experienced within the industry and socially in general. We started talking about changes that we have been wrought through these social movements, how COVID and some of the impacts of COVID have accelerated and made some of those conditions and movements more patent. Mm-hmm. And we wanted to talk about it and what is happening in the industry as a result.
Yeah, so it's not just social inflation, which is also, you know, a topic of conversation in insurance these days, but it's the idea of the way in which various causes have sort of come to public attention and been promoted and those sorts of things. How are you seeing them impact the insurance industry?
Well, we've seen it in a lot of different ways. I mean, you mentioned the social inflation, and certainly when you talk about social inflation, the size of verdicts, nuclear verdicts, we all use, that's become a common theme that people in the claims world and the insurance world are talking about. And I think that that's part of these social movements is people see insurance companies more as faceless, heartless and to a certain extent. And then there's also a growing just sense of anger and frustration at some of the things that are tied to all these different social movements. We've seen it with regard to some of the regulatory aspects. The NAIC is looking at and making the industry look inside itself more with regard to diversity, for equity, for inclusion, looking at the technology. We all want to use technology, and technology is a great thing, but AI and big data are becoming, you know, scrutinized because that tech, the data sets, for example, is a question. If the data set itself has some inherent characteristics that can create a discriminatory outcome, then there's a bigger concern about a company using that data set to make decisions and perpetuating a type of discrimination through that. That's being regulated. Colorado recently enacted a law that if a company is going to use AI or big data in its underwriting, that they have to test it on a regular basis to make sure that there is no inadvertent or overt, but primarily inadvertent discrimination. And they've got to be able to produce to the state and show that as an insurer, they're not discriminating in the way that that data is being used.
Yeah, I think it's a smart move on the part of NAIC and others to be thinking about that and approaching it. I know there's been a lot of criticism in the technology space, machine learning space, around these big language models that have been developed and kind of the data sets on which they've been trained, that sometimes they can have racist or sexist, or, you know, when the data that they're using comes from the web, there can be a lot of that. You want to be careful about not only issues like that in terms of the language that's being used, but obviously the outcomes as well. If you're using a third-party data source and it's suggesting in terms of the, I'll call it the algorithms, the computer code that have been built around that to make recommendations, and at the end of the day to make sure that they're tested appropriately. Right?
Well, even more traditional things that insurance companies have used to rate risk, like insurance scoring. We use insurance scoring every day, and the majority of the United States in the various states, they use insurance scoring to help determine risk and rates for insurance premiums. This has come under scrutiny. I think probably the most outstanding example of that right now, or at least the loudest one, has been the state of Washington. The insurance commissioner in Washington wanted to ban the use of insurance scoring. The industry, we've not taken kindly to that because this has been a very accurate predictor for us. But the state of Washington has taken on this issue because of the concern about not only just the social movements, but also with COVID, that people of color, people who are lower economic situations, because of all the impacts that they've had, are inherently their scores are being depressed. And if you continue to use it, then you just perpetuate a rating gap that shouldn't exist. Same thing with things like gender. Gender has become an issue when we look at it. We've always known that boys 18 to 25 are some of the highest insurance risks when you talk about auto. But that becomes a bigger question when you begin to look at the idea of what is gender. And what do you do when you have someone who is transgender or they're non-binary? How do you account for that part of, you know, your rating?
Yeah, it used to be pretty straightforward on the application, right? Are you male or female? And now because of, again, social movement or however you want to describe it, the way the world has evolved in that direction, even just asking those questions becomes challenging, not even getting to the point of how you use that information in order to try to rate risk.
That's right. I mean, Oregon, I think right now is the only state that actually gives you the option of putting male, female, or non-binary on your application. But other states are either working on adding a third category for gender or are taking away the use of gender altogether. California kind of did it in a step process. They added non-binary as a gender category, and now most recently have just said, nope, we're just getting rid of gender altogether. We're not even going to let you try and figure that out.
You can't ask about it.
No.
And how soon will it be before they start to disallow you to ask about age?
You know, I don't know the answer to that, but I think that it's a possibility that age becomes another question that you look at. I mean, the drive right now is to look at rating from strictly driving behaviors. And you've seen a lot of companies that are starting to go to, and they're tech solutions to a certain extent, where you've got the plug-in that they can track your mileage and it's usage-based and things that involve how you drive and can calculate what you're doing in your driving behaviors. And that may be the way of the world. Education is another one that's come under scrutiny. You know, employment, what you do for a living has come under scrutiny. And again, it's part of this social issue of, are we perpetuating certain disparities by using those categories, even though they seem neutral?
Yeah, it's a brave new world, I'll put it that way. But great for you and your co-authors on the piece that you guys put together that came out recently in the DRI magazine. It's an excellent read, and I'd certainly commend it to anybody that's listened to the podcast that hadn't picked it up yet to find a copy and read it, because it's a well done, very well done, very thoughtful.
And, well, thank you. It was really a joy to work with Elaine and Atoya on that particular article.
So I know that you're a frequent speaker on the tour.
Okay.
And I'm pretty sure I saw something of late that you're speaking at a conference there in your hometown.
I am. Well, what we are talking about next month is really attorney-client privilege and how to maintain attorney-client privilege in the coverage world, because there is a lot of scrutiny around that topic right now. And there are cases that are attempting to limit the attorney-client privilege. One of the cases that immediately comes to mind and will be a part of our discussion, I'm sure, is a recent Supreme Court case out of Mississippi, where the in-house counsel, not unlike myself, the in-house counsel worked with the adjuster, helped them draft a reservation of rights letter, helped them provide their coverage analysis. And the court found that the in-house counsel was essentially the ghost adjuster in the case. And everything became, outside of the privilege. And these are big concerns for insurance companies when you're looking at coverage and being able to seek advice of counsel and protect that.
Yeah, that is super important, to be able to make sure that the right advice is given without fear of it being unveiled in some way that negatively impacts the case handling or case outcome, right? You particularly don't want your attorneys to feel like somehow they can't give you candid advice around a matter for fear of that advice being discovered. I mean, it's really why the privilege exists, is to protect not attorneys, but the clients.
And it is to be able to give the client candid advice, candid counsel, and know that they can act on that and make decisions, and that discussion process and decision-making process is protected.
Correct. Correct. Well, I'm sure it's going to be a fascinating presentation. That's CLM.
It is for CLM. Yes, it's a CLM focus program that is being held here in Nashville.
Just go to the CLM website. You can sign up and register, right?
Absolutely. Please do. It's June 15th to the 17th.
Okay, great. Well, this has been a great conversation this afternoon, and I really appreciate you taking some time to join us and share about your claims journey, your insurance journey, and a few things that are top of mind right now. Before we wrap up, I don't know if there's anything else you'd like to share or bring up, but if people want to get in touch with you, what's the best way to do that?
They can always reach out to me at Acceptance. It's smcmurtry@acceptance.com. I would love to talk to people. I enjoy it. And if you want to talk about insurance coverage, I'm the person.
Okay. Okay. Well, listen, thanks again for joining us today. Great to have you as a guest and look forward to seeing you in June.
All right. Thanks a lot, Jim.
Well, it was a real pleasure to have Sarana Murtry as a guest on the Claim Edge podcast. I hope you enjoyed our conversation about claims, coverage, and social movements as much as I did. If you want to connect with Sarana, you can email her at Acceptance or meet her at the next CLM or FDCC conference. You can also find her on LinkedIn. Thanks for listening today. If you like this episode of Claim Edge, please subscribe on your favorite podcast channel and share it with your colleagues and friends. Until next time, this is Jim Chapman on the Claim Edge podcast, signing off.